Welcome to Fortress on a Hill. I'm Henry.
I'm Danny.
I'm Kagan.
We're three leftist veterans that aim to expose the reality of the U.S. military's multiple wars abroad and to illuminate the damage military service does to Americans.
American presidents throughout U.S. history have used American military and diplomatic power to force regime change of democratically elected governments around the world.
Most veterans come from families vested in prior service, and American generals choose their own, ensuring diversity of thought never interferes with American warmongering.
How can we stand by and do nothing while our military kills and destroys lives the world over, while telling Americans that all this death and destruction protects them from terrorists when nothing could be more false?
Fortress on a Hill aims to change that.
All right. Hey, listeners. Another Fortress on a Hill podcast. In another crazy week, in another crazy year. I mean, how many people have seen 2020, am I right, ? As people's status on any sort of social media? It's been nuts. We've had so much to talk about. Frankly, I think we're not covering so many of the issues that we should be because there's just too much. But luckily, we've had some guests come on who take the conversation in directions we might not think to go in, and kind of check some blocks for us because we don't have time any longer to do special episodes on each event. So there's nobody better to do that, to just talk about a range of issues in my experience than Steve Poikkanen, who is our guest today. He is the host of Slow News Day, which I think some listeners are familiar with already. Not just because I had been on it a few months ago, but in general. And he also co-hosts the Free Assange online vigil series. For those of you who don't know, the Slow News Day podcast, you know, as it describes itself, and I think this is great, chronicles late stage capitalism from the heart of the empire, right? And then brings on guests, you know, who are fighting to change that. But, you know, I think that's just a really great way of putting it, right? So late stage capitalism, late stage empire, these are related things. So when I was on Slow News Day with Steve, we had a pretty great, I thought, wide-ranging, maybe even zany in a good way, conversation. And so this should be interesting and in a good way. And so I'm really glad to have you, Steve, and thanks for doing it.
Oh, well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it. And yeah, I've been able to talk to you a couple of times on the vigil and then on my show, and I've felt really, really good about those conversations. I thought they went really well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there's definitely a bit of a flow, and more than once now, you know, your questions you've asked or discussions we've had have kind of informed an article series or something that I wrote, because as you know, I've been doing a lot of Lebanon stuff, and then you were the first person to kind of ask about that because the bombing essentially happened like the day of, just a few hours right before Assange vigil. So but before we get there, which I think we totally should, because I think there's something interesting about why there are so many conspiracy theories about Lebanon, and we'll get there, but maybe just give us a little background on you, right? So in other words, everyone does this, but you know, your personal kind of background and journey to where you're at today, you know, the key highlights of what you've done and where you're at now. And well, why do you give a shit, Steve, right? Like, why aren't you watching Real Housewives like everybody else? That's what I want you to answer.
Well, I'm going to be 100% truthful here. I'm 42 years old, and in the early 90s, I was introduced to both Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell and Clean LSD. And after that, you look at the world a little bit differently. And I had been involved in a political campaign before I could even vote. I was 16 years old. I was a campaign volunteer for a guy named David McIntosh, who was running for Congress in Indiana's 6th district, which is the district that Mike Pence was a representative from before he became governor. It gave me an insider's view on just how craven, ridiculous, and full of BS and lies politics are. So I decided that that would be about the last time that I involved myself in politics as a volunteer, but I began writing about it. In 2008, I was part of the nation's election blog team. I was subsequently, they didn't put it as I was being fired. They put it as I was invited to become successful elsewhere. When I wrote an article for them in the summer of 2008, detailing just how far to the right candidate Barack Obama was and how far to the right he would govern. That was not a narrative that the nation was willing to push. So they canned me, and I was subsequently blacklisted from getting a job as a political journalist in every form of legit media. So I decided to start my own show. And I've been able to have incredible conversations with people who at least agree on one thing. And that is, we can't begin to have an honest conversation about policy or politics or government unless we have access to primary source information that doesn't have to go through a spin machine before we're allowed to process it or digest it. And so out of that, you know, post-partisan framing, that's when I got invited to be a part of Action for Assange and co-host these vigil series, which we've been doing now for, I believe, 59 consecutive weeks. And that has just been one of the most bizarre and incredible experiences of my life. And I say that as a guy who has been through some stuff and seen some stuff. I don't know if I can swear on your show or not, so I'm trying.
Oh, really. Absolutely, you can.
Okay.
it's not acceptable. It's encouraged. No,
okay. Well, Danny Pearson, I've seen some shit.
Right.
But this is, you know, delving into how the national security state operates, how the Five Eyes Global Information Sharing Network operates, and how journalism is weaponized and the way that it's targeted to individuals or groups of individuals has just been one of the more incredible experiences of my life.
And I'm kind of glad that you know, I mean, the way you describe it, there's probably 1,000 different threads that lead anyone to something. But this idea of, you know, kind of first of all, where you're from, I mean, this whole, the Indiana connection is interesting to me because, you know, I first did a little canvassing for, I will admit, Obama while still in the army in southern Indiana, right? Because I've been stationed at Fort Knox, as you know, right across the border. And,
yeah,
you know, Indiana's an interesting state, right? It's when Obama won it in 2008, it was like the first time since 64. And people don't realize, like, the Klan was big there, like super big for a long time, and that there's a lot of bellwether there.
The county that I grew up in, and the county that Mike Pence represented for a number of years, is where the quote unquote capital of the Klan was housed, a little town called Elwood, Indiana. When I was in high school, we'd go there for, I think the time I went there was for track. Anderson, Indiana, where I'm from, is a very mixed city. In terms of, like, you know, black people, white people, Mexicans, things like that. It's the intersection of agriculture and industry because it was a huge GM town until NAFTA. In fact, Chris Hedges, one of your fairly frequent guests, mentioned Anderson, Indiana in America, the Farewell Tour. And just kind of as an example of what happened when NAFTA was passed and how it affected towns in the Rust Belt. But when I went for a track meet, there were signs up. This is in the mid-90s, early 90s, signs in people's yards about N-word, go home. And we got there, and at the high school, there were Confederate flags with nooses hanging off of them and stuff like that. I did not enjoy having multiple races come to their town for sporting events. It was surreal.
Wow. Yeah. And of course, the Mike Pence factor to me is a demonstrative of the long-standing connection, right? Not for everyone, but there is a long-standing connection, or at least kind of correlation, between this like evangelical thread in American society and this like racial and Klan thread. It's very rarely an accident, right? It's very rare that the two haven't been in some ways connected. And I'm sure that you saw some version of that growing up. Would that be a fair assessment?
Absolutely. One white gloved hand washes the other. There's unlimited amounts of religious justification for bigotry, for racism, if you want there to be. And you see this where the area where I grew up was outside of town, very rural. In fact, the house that I grew up in was sandwiched in between like three plots of farmland. But you get this, I guess, pockets of a homogenous culture, even though you live in a town, you know, you quote unquote live in a town that has people from all backgrounds. And there are people who maintain their ethnic purity, as such as it is, shrouded in religion, and don't see the disconnect. And when you try to talk to them about the disconnect, the first thing they do is tune you out immediately. You know, like, it's impossible to have these conversations with people who have been taught their entire lives that, you know, they are genetically superior to another human being based solely on their skin color or nation of origin. And it's just, I mean, really hard it was really hard for me to wrap my head around, because that's not the way that we were brought up, you know, but our neighbors were. And so no small amount of, you know, interpersonal conflict. And I got the hell out of that state as soon as I could. I think that it's called the Crossroads of America for a reason, because you're not just supposed to stop and stand in the crossroads. You're supposed to keep moving. So
right,
I did.
Right. No, that's just such an interesting, like, geographical but like cultural and historical background. And I think that there are very few guests, like there are very few people from any particular place where there's not something about where they're from that informs a, you know, a degree of what happens later. But then you also sort of describe this media journey, right? Like doing some presidential stuff on the blog for The Nation, and I guess what I wanted to ask is your experience in media, right, as you push through, or probably some of your frustrations with that, it sounds like, reasonably, how did they sort of inform your work for Action for Assange? In other words, like, why does Assange matter would be the big question, and then like the smaller question is like, how does that connect to your experiences with media leading into that, right?
Excellent questions there. So Julian Assange matters, and WikiLeaks matters, because we do get to see that unspun primary source material that allows people to make up their own minds about how the world works and how governments truly operate, how both public and private security agencies operate, who they're targeting, and we're kind of on the precipice of determining whether or not investigative journalism as a thing continues to exist. If Julian Assange is, we don't use the word extradited anymore. We got lectured by a French gentleman named Victor Dedage as to, you know, we should stop using the language of empire when we communicate this. Julian Assange is not going to be extradited to the United States as much as he's going to be renditioned. And it's going to take place in broad daylight in a courtroom, a kidnapping of a journalist and publisher who will be brought to the U.S., placed under special administrative measures, and more or less tortured to death under a 175-year sentence for publishing the truth, for publishing vetted, verifiable, unquestioned documents. There's never been a single point in WikiLeaks history where there was a lawsuit that determined the material that they published was false. They have a 100% accuracy rating, making them unique in the world of journalism. And because we don't get that from other outlets, because we don't have a, our version, because we have our version of state media, what we get are think tank talking points and propaganda and, you know, red team, blue team spin. So WikiLeaks is incredibly unique. Julian Assange is incredibly unique because what they're doing is providing us, they're providing us with the ability to make up our own minds. And that's not something we normally see in media. And of course, you know, 17 charges under the Espionage Act and an additional now expanded conspiracy to commit computer intrusion charge. The U.S. Department of Justice is trying to criminalize investigative journalism. And if that's allowed to happen, we only have state-approved news segments. We only have national security state talking points. And that's not how a free society functions. And the way that that has informed what we do and the way that it's shaped what we do is we try to emulate the model of WikiLeaks' scientific journalism, which is looking at a document or looking at a set of documents or transcribed testimony and dissecting it, not letting outside influences, personal biases, things of that nature take over too much in our reporting. I mean, certainly we do have a bias. We would like to see Julian Assange free and alive and working. But that also means that we personally believe that there should be 80 or 100 or 500 outlets doing exactly what WikiLeaks is doing. And the competition in media shouldn't be who can get the highest ratings based off of infotainment. It should be who is dealing in accuracy.
Yeah. And yet there aren't, right? I mean,
no.
not only are there not other Julian Assange WikiLeaks sources, there's also no talk of him on the media. Like this trial, right? It's blacked out to some extent.
This trial determines the course of journalism going forward. This is the single biggest press freedom trial in my lifetime, certainly. And the media blackout over it, at first it was frustrating, then it was frightening, and now it's just tragic. Because there are a lot of people who are walking around acting like they might not be next. And we're talking about the reporters who published the Afghan papers through the Washington Post last year. There is the Australian Broadcasting Company published their own version of the Afghan papers. And that was material that came through a whistleblower, the Australian Army lawyer named David McBride. He's facing 50 years, and the journalist who published it is also subject to charges. So we've seen, just since the George Floyd protests began, over 700 journalists who have been shot, tear gassed, shot at, locked up, detained. This is a global war on journalism, and the public is largely unaware. Because if the news doesn't tell them about it, if they're not being told what to think and how to think about it, they don't think about it. And this goes double for politicians. We only heard Julian Assange's name once or twice in the entire Democratic primary, and that came out of Tulsi Gabbard's mouth, who was already being smeared as a Russian asset and an Assad apologist. So if your pet politician isn't talking about this, if your Congress critters aren't talking about this, then you as an individual citizen aren't focused on it. It goes the exact same for, you know, content creators and journalists, people involved in YouTube and that kind of deal. If you essentially train your audience, if you can follow this for a moment, as a content creator, we train our audiences and we give them areas of interest that are based on our areas of interest. And if all you're doing with your show is covering the day-to-day of an illegitimate election in a horse race for, you know, clicks and AdSense revenue, then you are training your audience to only respond to that subject. And it closes them off from being open to hearing about what is going on with Julian Assange or with Lebanon or with Syria, any place that the empire has expanded to. I never hear a content creator talk about the ramped up role of AFRICOM over the last 7 to 10 years. You know, the way that we monetized thought and put it out on these platforms has allowed for rigid control of the conversation. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely. I'm glad you brought up the AFRICOM thing because, yeah, Henry, I'll turn it over to you, but like this foreign policy connection is huge.
So I'd like to discuss Chelsea Manning and her relationship with Julian a little bit.
Okay.
Chelsea, of course, you know, went to major media outlets like the New York Times and the Washington Post before refusing to, or who both refused to take any of the documents before she contacted Julian and WikiLeaks. Now, I served two tours in Iraq, so the Iraq war logs, among other topics in her releases, are an incredibly precious resource to me, along with Chelsea herself. The fact that an active duty soldier chose humanity over militarism, it means the world to me. Steve, I was wondering if you could discuss a little bit about the relationship between Chelsea and Julian, how he helped her in those early days of the Obama administration, and do you honestly think the U.S. government will ever leave her alone, whether as trying to target Assange with the recent grand juries or other activists?
Wow. So I'll answer the second question first. And I would love to say, yes, Chelsea will be left alone to, you know, the stream on Twitch and not discuss anything related to her incarceration or her reincarceration or her torture or the role she played in changing the way that millions of Americans saw the U.S. military in the war in Iraq and the war in Afghanistan. However, we live in an empire. The citizens of empire are subjected to the whims of the rulers. And we saw this with Chelsea Manning in that the way that her sentence was commuted instead of her receiving a full pardon, she was then subject to being reincarcerated, which she was. All for pointing out the secret and illegal nature of the grand jury process. I'm an activist, and so, you know, inside there's a core of hope within me. It's kind of protected by this, you know, layer of cynicism. But I always maintain hope that we're going to win this. I always maintain hope that Chelsea Manning will live a full and long life for the rest of her days without being subjected to the whims of empire. But I know that that should a reason be manufactured to haul her back in front of another secret grand jury, then this process will start up all over again. And what she did and how she did it, it not only exposes war crimes and fraud and abuse and torture, but it exposed the hubris of the military in that nothing that she gave to Julian Assange was password protected. She did not even need a username or a login to get that material. It was just sitting there for anyone who had access to that network to see. So what Julian did in terms of helping her was, you know, he certainly gave her avenues that she could explore within that open network, open to her network. But as soon as she became a suspect through an organization called Freedom of the Press Foundation that Julian had set up with John Perry Barlow in the background, to where WikiLeaks and Julian wouldn't be in the forefront of this organization, they raised a substantial amount of money for her legal defense fund. He spoke on her behalf for years and years and years and highlighted just, he called it punishment as process for what was being done to Chelsea Manning while she was both in Leavenworth and then in different prisons. You can't look at I don't know, years and years of videotape of him speaking on this without thinking, compared to the rest of the media, this is so far above and beyond what any other publishing outlet has ever done for a whistleblower, that the only thing that you're left to kind of take away from it is, not only does this man care about this person, but he's fighting for her as much as she fought to not be broken by the system that she spoke out against. Like, there seems to be a very deep mutual and abiding respect between the two of them. I hope that answers your question. If it didn't, let me know or follow up, and I'll try and.
You know. Oh, absolutely! No, you totally hit the nail on the head. How do you think her story has? This might be a little too abstract, but if you'll forgive me, how do you think her story and her journey has changed whistleblowing? It's just such an incredible story, and. I hope to meet her sometime. I don't know what the status is of her life, you know, right now. I know that as was her time in prison before, that she was horribly treated, and I honestly hope that she finds a home other than the United States so that she might have some kind of peace going forward with her life. But no, just an incredible story and an incredible, you know, path forged by her.
Currently she's in Brooklyn, New York, and she's a Twitch streamer 4 days a week, Thursday through Sunday, from I believe 4 to 7 p.m. Pacific. So you can actually check in with her and you can leave a comment letting her know that you appreciate her. They don't really go into her story or discuss it on the Twitch stream. But you can, I encourage people to just drop by and say, hey, thanks, we love you. And then split if you want to. But what she kind of broke the Obama administration's war on whistleblowers. And the end result of her treatment of the torture that she had been subjected to by the Obama administration set up internal protections for whistleblowers going forward after about 2015. changing in so many ways, you know, at least on paper, the protections that whistleblowers now have. Prior to the Manning leaks, it was purely open season on whistleblowers. And even inside individual organizations, be they public or private, there was no sort of safety net. There was no on paper protection for what they were, if they chose to blow the whistle. So in terms of that, now whether it's enforced and upheld is entirely different and purely arbitrary, in my opinion. But we never would have had that had people of all different walks of life who may have, you know, didn't have anything to do with the military or with trans rights or, you know, activism in general. We're so captivated by her story and we're so simultaneously like horrified and then filled with that, I you know, the kind of like butterflies you get with new knowledge, or at least that I get with new knowledge. Like, she opened up so many people's eyes to the horrors of the occupations in Afghanistan and Iraq. And I think that, or I hope that if we have a history 100 years from now, that history itself will be incredibly kind to her, because she really was a hero.
Absolutely, and that's how we treat her here. The guys and I love doing the podcast. Being able to share our experiences in the military with allies and supporters means the world to us. But we can't do all the work. We need you to share an episode of ours with someone, anyone whom you like might think might be affected by it. Young people looking to join the military, or parents advocating for one, conscientious citizens who care about the violence the U.S. wages in their name, advocates for women and people of color who understand the harsh environment the military creates for females and minorities, and inflicts on minorities around the globe, and anyone else you think it might affect, please take a moment, pause the episode, share this with them. Now, our podcast is supported in a few different ways. First, there's Patreon, where we're blessed to have an array of wonderful supporters helping the guys and I pay for some of the podcast's expenses. Those who contribute $10 a month or more will be mentioned right here as an honorary producer, helping keep you, our listeners, stocked with new episodes. But you don't have to contribute $10 a month to help us. For as little as a dollar a month, you can keep us going, paying for hosting and storage fees, transcribing old and new episodes, promoting and expanding the podcast, and more I'm sure I can't think of at the moment. So, let's bring out these honorary producers. And they are Will Arenz, Fahim Shirazi, James Zobar, Adam Bellows, Eric Phillips, Paul Appel, Julie Dupree, Thomas Benson, Emma P., Janet Hansen, Lawrence Taylor, Tristan Oliver, Marwan Marwan, and the Status Quo Podcast. Your contributions are wonderfully helpful to us. Thank you so much. However, if Patreon isn't your style, you can always contribute directly to us through PayPal at paypal.me/ForgeSonaHill. Or please check out our store on Spreadshirt.com. Make sure you check for promo codes before you order. And now, let's get back to the podcast.
You know, one of the things that is interesting about all this is, you mentioned how if anybody, you know, defends Julian Assange, defends Chelsea Manning, speaks up for press freedom and their role as representative of it, then the reflex, of course, is that they're a Putin apologist or
you know, or lackey or Assad on Putin's behalf. And I was thinking about that. Steve, I don't know if you've seen, or Henry, that Rogan clip where I think it's Barry Weiss or whatever her name is, the New York Times journalist is on.
Yeah,
she says to Rogan, like, when he brings up all the different candidates that are in the race, like, just to get her think her view on it, as soon as he says Tulsi Gabbard, she's like, oh, come on, she's an Assad toady. And then, of course, he, like, asks the follow-on, like, well, why do you say that? But I think he was looking for, like, well, what's the evidence that she's a toady? And Weiss is, like, kind of like, I don't, she wasn't even sure what toady meant. She was like, I think I'm using that word correctly. And what struck me about it is,
Jamie, could you look that up real quick?
Yeah, it's an incredible clip. And, like, I just rewatched it the other day. And in other words, like, you're a columnist at the New York Times, the paper of record. You're using a word that is essentially the same as saying someone is, like, all but a traitor, a sitting congresswoman. Right. And you miss, you're like either using or misusing. You're not even sure what it means. But the pejorative is to say this sitting congresswoman, veteran of our wars, is essentially a traitor. And you don't even have to get that right or even know anything about the Assad family or the Syrian civil war. You can ask on the air for the producer of that show or like the administrator to look up the word to make sure you're using the pejorative of her being a traitor. Right. And there are no consequences. Like, that to me was, like, the mainstream media and microcosm. Like, so you, if you defend, like Tulsi had, you say any words about Assange, like, you can be smeared as a traitor to your country despite being a veteran, and there's no consequences for, like, the mainstream media. So it really does – I think it kind of links together your experience in media leading up to this and then your fight for Assange now, right? I don't really have a question. I just want to know what you think about that.
No, I my favorite thing about that, my favorite thing about the Barry Weiss interview and what happened as a fallout from that is it gave us a brand new word in the English lexicon, and that word is smugnerant. And it's I don't have the exact definition in front of me. It's part of the Urban Dictionary now, but it's where you know, a basic fundamental misunderstanding of how the world works meets with the hubris that you only get when you have the kind of institutional security that Barry Weiss has. It's a microcosm of establishment media. And credit to the Jimmy Dore show for showing that clip in a live show that spawned the word smugnerant. I tell people
it really is a perfect word.
I tell people on my show all the time that we live in a fucking cartoon, and this is just one of those things that, yeah, it's a joke, but it's starting to not be a joke anymore. We really do live in a cartoon, and that clip. And that little scene there that happened on Joe Rogan's show is just so indicative of the cartoon. And people still listen to Barry Weiss. I don't know how many anymore.
Right, but, right.
You know, I mean, she was able to keep her job after that. I remember a day when Jon Stewart went in Crossfire and completely obliterated both Paul Begala and Tucker Carlson. And within, like, 2 months, the show was completely canceled because a comedian was able to shine a little light on what the show was and how it operated. They were so embarrassed they couldn't keep doing it anymore. And now it's like, well, we can just censor this person. We can just bury them by algorithm. We can remove their YouTube channel, or we can take away their ability to make a living by doing, you know, independent media content creation. And there's no... I guess this is all an outward manifestation of fear, but there's seemingly no fear on the part of the people in power, because all they have to do is enter a few keystrokes and somebody's Twitter account is gone, or somebody's YouTube channel is gone, or their website gets taken down. And these decisions are made seemingly arbitrarily, But it always goes one direction, Danny. It always goes against the people who are speaking outside of the narrative, regardless of where they fall politically.
Absolutely. And the thing about her not losing her job, the thing about her still working at the New York Times, to me is, you know, indicative of why they don't fight for Assange. You know, and I said this the first time that I was on the Vigil with you guys, and I'm sure you've heard it a thousand times, but this whole idea of like the mainstream's choosing not to stand with Julian because, you know, they are the toadies really for the establishment, but, you know, regardless, they don't stand with him. And then there's one school of thought that thinks that that means that this is like the Nazi analogy where someday they're going to wish they had, because, you know, they're going to go for the Assanges of the world, and next thing you know, they're going to come for them, you know, like the Jews, the communists, all that stuff. But actually, yeah, in a sense, that assumes that they don't already work for the state, the Washington Post, the New York Times. But the fact that she still has her job, the fact that, you know, people still read these folks, and that you don't even have to know what you're talking about to be assigned the beat of a certain subject for the paper of record of America, you know, is to me instructive that maybe it's the second one, right? Maybe it's the latter. Maybe they've worked for the state for a long, long time. And that's why the fight, or part of why the fight, you know, Action for Assange, et cetera, is so important.
There's a book by Joel Whitney called Finks, F-I-N-K-S, and the subtitle is How the CIA Tricked the World's Best Journalists. And it goes, the book opens in the late 40s, right after World War II, and it talks about how the CIA set up all of these journalistic outlets all over the planet. And that, yes, the editors knew that they were working for the CIA. And yes, the journalists in many cases knew that they were working for the CIA. And they still had their own hubris inside of them that made them think like, OK, well, it's just this one article, you know, or it's just this one angle that I'm being a parrot for, but I'm still my own person. And as you get further and further into the book, you discover that no, in fact, their lives have been completely taken over by this organization, that if they don't write the words that they're told, then they're subjected to being targeted. They're subjected to surveillance. Their bank accounts can disappear. Their home lives can be destroyed. And that has so permeated the culture of media in the last, Jesus, what is that, 70 years now? 70 years? That if people aren't fully aware that they're functionaries of the state, it's only because they've deluded themselves well enough. You know what I mean? Like, they know. They know that they're doing state reporting. They know what they're allowed right to print, and they know the limits of dissent that they're allowed to share. And they'll never cross that line, because crossing that line could get them 175 years in a supermax.
Yeah. No, I mean, absolutely. So it's like a self, you know, they're going to self-censor. And I think initially maybe it comes from, oh, you know, like they want to protect their sources, or they want to, you know, keep their job. And then, you know, that's bad enough that that's been going on. I mean, I think I've read about, you know, how Chris Hedges has talked about how he was surprised by how many journalists, you know, in Bosnia or any of the other places he worked would just self-censor. They didn't even have to be told by the military or the government, hey, don't report this. But now what we're finding out is that there's a whole other angle, the Orwellian rather than the, you know, Huxley angle, which is we will really put you in jail for two human lifespans back to back if you embarrass us. I mean, really, that's it too, right? If you embarrass us, that seems to be the key.
That's what it comes down to ultimately. Yeah. When you thumb your nose at the powers that be, whether they're in positions of real power or perceived power, like Congress. When you thumb your nose at them, the reaction is across the board. Smears. The reaction is to destroy you, and people who are aware of that will absolutely engage in self-censorship because they've been able to enjoy a certain amount of personal freedom or personal comfort in being a journalist or in being a part of even the independent media. I can't tell you how frustrating it is to be a member of the independent media and an advocate for Julian Assange, because even in quote unquote indie media, that self-censorship is so prevalent because of the way that thought has been monetized, and because your livelihood is connected to, you know, not violating a terms of service agreement that you didn't read that has been put into place by, you know, Alphabet Inc. or Google's parent company, or Google or YouTube. YouTube just recently announced that they're going to take down any videos that discuss hacked material. And that puts a giant target on my show, and it puts a giant target on Action for Assange, of course, because we're showing you information from WikiLeaks basically two times a week. And that's not just censorship. That's not just Orwellian or Huxleyan. It is, my God, it's Stalinist. You know, the Stasi would look at the way that the U.S. operates right now and be like, my God, I didn't know I could do that. Did you know we could do that? Did you know we could get them to do that? I didn't know. They would be floored at the rate at which people intentionally hide under a desk to avoid the truth.
Yeah, no, that's an interesting point. Like the idea that the Stasi has something to learn from the U.S. You know, it's common among like historians to bring up like, oh, you know, like, Hitler sort of respected a lot of, you know, America's eugenics programs and, you know, the British Empire and what the Americans did to the Native Americans. And I think, you know, there was some truth in that, and he took it to the next level. But then you also look at today's media space and you can't help but wonder exactly what you said. Are the Putins of the world, like, who are supposed to be the worst and much worse folks than Putin, are they looking at the United States going, oh, that's how you do it? You extradite a guy from an allied country after like stealing him out of an embassy and all this, and then you put him on trial and you get your media, your independent, world respected supposedly media, not to talk about it. That's power, right? I mean, that is gangster, is what that is.
And like,
if I'd want to do that if I was a dictator.
Oh yeah. Ralph Nader, he was talking about political parties when he said this, but it's true for media too. The only difference, Nader said, between Republicans and Democrats is the velocity at which your knees hit the floor when the donors come calling. The only difference between state media and independent media, or establishment media and independent media, and I'm gonna say it's 95% of independent media. The only difference is they're tailoring their message to confirm the biases of a particular ideology. But at no point are they actually educating their audiences. At no point are they challenging their audiences. And what we have is this like sick, empty discussion about things that are either fabricated out of whole cloth, like Russiagate, or just there to confirm the biases of, well, okay, red team is good, or Trump is good, or Joe Biden is good, or maybe Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is good. And that's it. That's the end of the story. Like, you can point your finger and wag it at establishment media as an independent content creator, but almost in every case, in every show that people have, they're still using mainstream establishment content as the baseline for their show. They're not going out and they're not interviewing independent journalists. They're not going out and they're not talking to, you know, members of Julian Assange's legal team or like Laurie Love, someone who actually successfully fought off being extradited to the U.S. He's not getting a place to speak anywhere other than through like Consortium News or the Don't Extradite Assange campaign. And again, this comes back to, you know, having a trained audience. The audience tunes out when you start talking about the death of investigative journalism, because it's not Bernie good or Nancy Pelosi bad or Ted Cruz crazy. It's as disheartening as it is, it's also one of the things that gives me drive and makes me try even harder to, you know, find journalists who aren't afraid to speak outside of the narrative, which is why I had you on my show, Danny. You're one of those guys.
Well, I appreciate that.
So is Vanessa Beely, and she'll be on tomorrow. I'm looking forward to that.
So I wanted to ask about something from this past primary season among the Democrats. Bernie Sanders' campaign did something really odd, something that I didn't see coming, and I'd like your opinion on it. He chose to publicly state that he would no longer use the Espionage Act against whistleblowers. Now, it's certainly not out of the realm of possibility for somebody like Bernie, but even still, it felt it was an incredible gesture. Steve, I'm curious, how did you view this news from the Sanders campaign earlier this year?
We said prove it. We said prove it and name names and talk about why the espionage should not be used to prosecute whistleblowers. And the response that we got back was, we don't want to go into specifics. And it felt like kind of a cheap trick. Like it did. Like, it's possible that Bernie Sanders doesn't, you know, would not want to use the Espionage Act to prosecute whistleblowers. It's possible. But Bernie's entire career, with the exception of voting against the Iraq war that one time while supporting every subsequent funding bill, has been to roll over for the national security state. So, I believe it was Ryan Grimm that he said that to. I'm not 100% on that. I know he did like a joint interview with AOC. Ryan Grimm was the interviewer, and Ryan Grimm specifically brought up Reality Winner. And before Bernie could even get a word out, like, AOC was going, oh, well, no, we're not here to talk about specifics. So to me, that came off as more of a platitude than a campaign promise. I would like to think that we do have elected officials that understand how dangerous it is to use the Espionage Act to prosecute a whistleblower. But even if they understand the danger in it, the odds of them being able to go around or over or through the national security state are pretty non-existent.
Yeah, I felt very much that it was it seemed nice to hear it, but how was he going to follow through? And it just seemed cheaper and cheaper as more time went on without additional follow through.
Yeah, I agree with that 100%. I do. And so much of Bernie's campaign this time around, it was like he was phoning it in. He didn't have it. He didn't have the heart for it. My personal opinion about Bernie Sanders is that he's a sheepdog for the Democratic Party. and his primary function is to keep people inside of a party that has never and will never represent them by giving them the false hope that, well, if you just elect enough of us, then eventually maybe we'll start to make a dent. And I'll put it this way, and I say this on Slow News Day. If you've got a machine and the machine was designed to kill 99% of us, your solution to the problems posed by that machine shouldn't be, let's slap a couple shiny new parts on it every 2 to 4 years, because then all you're doing is prolonging the life of a machine designed to kill you. And that's what, you know, progressive politics inside the Democratic Party is. It's putting a couple of shiny new parts on that machine, thinking that that's going to solve the design problem instead of prolong the life of the machine. I hope that makes sense. I would still a little scattered.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
So, Steve, as we kind of close out, let me ask you, to your knowledge, was there a mention of, you know, Assange or like the real issues of press freedom during the, what, 4 days or so of the Democratic convention? I mean, what was there? I mean, was there any real discussion? And if so, was it even maybe the opposite direction?
You know, I gotta be perfectly honest here. I didn't watch a moment of the DNC this year. I've seen a couple of clips, but Tuesday night while we were live on the air for the Assange vigil, I had my phone started vibrating, which is weird because it's always on mute, and it was an emergency evacuation order because the place, the town that I live in, Boulder Creek, California, was being threatened by wildfire. And it still is. I had to evacuate. I'm about 300 miles away from home right now, and don't have a lot of answers about what's going on with my town. But I will tell you this, from what I've gathered from the DNC convention this year, it was a show of solidarity with the good Republicans. And any mention of press freedom is centered around Jim Acosta shouldn't have been removed from the White House press corps that day. Not that we have a systemic war on real journalism. So that when the Democrats frame something like press freedom, it's always going to revolve around the people who already have that institutional security, people who already have who are access journalists, not who are genuine, I'm going to expose the problems that we have in this country, journalists. So with the DNC, it's always about optics. It's never about getting to the core of a problem and solving it. If we're talking about press freedom, then again, it's always going to be about, like, let Jim Acosta speak, not let Julian Assange speak. If it's about diversity, it's diversity for optics' sake, never diversity of opinion.
Well, yeah, I admit that in asking you, I should have known better, of course. I was kind of hoping maybe you had watched more than I had, because I did not have the stomach either. So, you know, I read some transcripts and, you know, tried to just get the highlights. But, man, I'll tell you, I did not have it in me either, because it's such a circus. And really, it's like a best in show, like Christopher Guest style pageant. It really is. I mean, it's just as absurdist as that, right? It was like one big kneel while wearing that like quasi African garb that Pelosi organized in Congress. It was that, basically, you know, but for like 4 days and like their whole thing.
And look, you know, they rigged another primary this year, and it's the second time that this has happened in a four-year period where we just had a blatantly illegitimate primary. And they did it to put forth a candidate in Joe Biden that both on paper and in rhetoric wants to govern to the right of Donald Trump, except for completely symbolic and empty gestures. And they're hoping that your 4 years of nonstop fear porn about the bad orange man will be enough to carry a man in Joe Biden who, let's be perfectly honest, has instant grits where his brain should be. It's a sad state of affairs.
Well, I mean, these are all, like, these are the issues, right? The Assange story and the stuff about the press that you're talking about is the one issue or one of a few that's related to everything. There's, like, no way around that. And so, you know, as we kind of wrap up here, I just think that what I'm so thankful for is that we got to know each other, to have these conversations, to continue them. Because if we can make fun of the DNC all day, we can talk about the empire all day, and we could talk about that Rogan appearance. But, you know, what you have kind of identified is that the Assange story touches it all, because press freedom is at the root of it. And, you know, until we have that and we're fighting in its name, this is what we almost deserve. This is what we got. And so, yeah, with that, Steve, I just want to thank you for coming on. And then, hey, tell our listeners where they should be checking you out, you know, in the next couple, like, week or two, but just in general as well.
Okay, certainly. And thank you so much for having me on your show. I'm a fan of this show. I listen to it regularly. It's an honor to be here. You've had some incredible guests, so I'm a little bit humbled and terrified that I'm not going to measure up. But you can find me, if you're looking on YouTube, you type in Slow News Day Podcast. I'm also on the Rockfin and DLive as Slow News Day. I am at Slow News Day Show on Twitter. The Action for Assange everything is Action, the number for Assange, the YouTube channel, the Rockfin channel, the website, www.action4assange.com. We put out weekly calls to action. So, anyone can be a part of this. This is a intentionally decentralized network of activists. We are going back to Washington, D.C. We did in February for the first week of Julian's show trial. We will be back from the 5th of September through the 25th, because the hearing, they set aside 3 weeks for it. So we will be holding demonstrations and panels and events throughout Washington, D.C. If you can, please join us for that. We would love to have more boots on the ground, as it were. And this is both to you and to your listeners. If any of your listeners are in the D.C. area, please, during the first 3 weeks of September, come out and see us and be a part of this. Because, again, this is the biggest press freedom trial of our lifetimes is taking place in virtual silence, and it is incumbent on us, as you know, people who want to attain self-determination and to hold back the coming dystopia, to stand together and fight for this.
Well, Steve, you know, you can count on our support in, you know, a number of different ways. We're going to plug stuff in the show notes to get people, you know, who aren't already checking out Slow News Day. This, you know, the DC kind of event and just prioritizing this. So, you know, we're super happy to have you, and let's do it again. Let's keep going back and forth, know, the three of us between each other's shows, and spread the word. And yeah, this has been great. Thanks so much. And do check out Steve's various work, because it is worth it.
Well, thank you. Very much. And you guys, yeah, you guys are incredible. I think what you do is vital to help people kind of pull back the curtain on U.S. Empire.
Well, we're trying, and I think we're all in the same fight. So thanks so much, and we'll do more of this. We'll do more of this, and I have a feeling that there's going to be plenty to fight against for a long time.
I agree.
We're on Twitter at Fortress on a Hill, and also at Facebook.com at Fortress on a Hill. You can find our main blog page and our full collection of episodes at www.fortressonahill.com. iTunes, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, Patreon, Spotify. You name it, almost anywhere you listen, we're already waiting for you. And hey, we're always in the market for more Patreon supporters. Please consider becoming a patron at patreon.com. And if you're not into giving us a monthly payment, think about giving us a couple bucks on PayPal. The link is in the show notes. Skepticism is one's best armor. Never forget it. We'll see you next time.
And listen to my song. I hope you'll pay attention. I will not.